Good morning, early birds. You've caught The Worm, a podcast from Yellowstone Public Radio, rounding up reporting from our newsroom and Montana Public Radio. Today we have stories about a live shooter training in Billings, fish kill along the banks of the Upper Clark Fork River, and breeding barley for the craft beer boom. It's Tuesday, September 10th. I'm your host, Jess Sheldahl. A former head of the Montana Republican Party is entering the 2020 race for the state's lone seat in the U.S. House. Montana Public Radio's Corin Cates-Carney reports.
Deborah Lamb is now the fifth Republican in the party's primary race for the U.S. House seat, which the GOP has held for more than two decades. The seat is currently held by Republican Greg Gianforte, who is not seeking re-election and is running for governor. Lamb was the chair of the Montana Republican Party during the 2018 election cycle and represented the Livingston area for a single term in the State House of Representatives from 2015 to 2017. Lamb is closely aligning herself with President Donald Trump as she kicks off her primary campaign. In her announcement email Monday, Lamb said socialism is a great threat to America, and she will stand with President Trump to, quote, keep Montana and America great, unquote. Other declared candidates in the Republican primary for the U.S. House are State Auditor Matt Rosendale, Secretary of State Corey Stapleton, Chair of the Lewis and Clark County Republican Party Joe Dooling, and Corvallis Superintendent of Schools Timothy Johnson. Lamb did not respond to an email and a phone call requesting comment for this story. I'm Corin Cates-Carney, Montana Public Radio.
Those awaiting the final Superfund cleanup deal or consent decree for the Butte Hill and urban Silver Bow Creek corridor are going to have to wait a little longer. Montana Public Radio's Nora Sachs explains.
On Monday, the Environmental Protection Agency announced that the parties negotiating the legally binding cleanup agreement, which include EPA, the state, the county, and Atlantic Richfield, have agreed to a second 30-day extension to finish hammering out the details. EPA says the parties are making progress, but the agency needs more time to respond to public comments on proposed changes to the cleanup plan. Those changes are the backbone of the deal to assign final financial responsibility for the cleanup. The extension also gives a local advocacy group more time to study whether their vision of a free-flowing Upper Silver Bow Creek is compatible with the new cleanup plan on the table. The Superfund parties now have until October 11th to finalize the agreement, and it will take several more weeks to get it signed and lodged in U.S. District Court. I'm Nora Sachs, Montana Public Radio.
A synagogue in Billings, Montana, held an active shooter training this past weekend. It joins a growing number of businesses, places of worship, and schools taking similar steps. Kayla DeRoche reports.
Billings Police Officer Tom Keatley stands in the synagogue library Sunday afternoon and pulls a volunteer for a demonstration.
What's your name?
Lynn.
Lynn, you're going to take this gun away from me. Come on.
Okay.
Lynn follows him to the doorway.
Now push down, and I'm going to lift up as hard as I can.
She shoves his hands and gun towards the ground, away from about 15 other members of the congregation there for the training.
There's nothing. Even if I pull the trigger right now, nobody's hurt.
This could have been an alien scenario to the people here, far-reaching and unlikely. But it's not.
I mean, when did you think about what it would be like for somebody to explode the glass in the front door, walk through, and begin killing people?
All the time.
That's a common response from the people in the room.
I think it's part of being Jewish.
Temple board member Diane Kirsten is talking about a fear she's had her whole life.
Always. Yeah. Yeah. I think our combined memory causes us to be aware of violence toward us.
Yeah, it's a concern you've had ever since I was young.
That's Al Page, the Temple Board Treasurer. He says he often considers the possibility of a shooting at the synagogue.
Every time we have services, every time we have High Holy Days, whatever the case may be, I'm always worried about people being around.
Rabbi Eric Uriarte says shootings at synagogues over the past 2 years bring those fears to the forefront.
For Jews in America, it may have been something that was always in the back of our minds, and the shootings in Pittsburgh and the shooting in Poway just sort of exacerbated that fear.
Uriarte says he's felt welcomed in Billings, and in the past, he has referenced Montana's support of the Jewish community. In the 1990s, an anti-Semitic act in Billings inspired Montanans to take a stand and eventually adopt the slogan, "Not in our town." Residents stuck by that. In 2017, when neo-Nazis tried unsuccessfully to organize an armed march in Whitefish, two women put together the Love Not Hate Block Party that drew hundreds of participants despite frigid temperatures. But domestic terrorism is perhaps most frightening because it can happen anywhere to anyone, not just to vulnerable populations. Officer Tom Keatley says that's part of why the active shooter training has become the department's most requested program since it kicked off 3 years ago.
It's a problem in the United States everywhere. It's not a big city problem. It's not a small town problem. It doesn't matter race, religion, gender. None of these things matter. And everybody's afraid of this happening in their hometown, in their church or synagogue or place of business or Costco or wherever. And so everybody's taking it seriously, as they should.
He says the training typically goes an hour long and focuses on the run, hide, and fight protocol. It also covers everyday resources you can use to barricade a door to stop entry or a bullet. Keatley says most of the large established churches in Billings have asked for trainings for their congregation or staff, and many businesses have too.
Surgery centers and optometry places and retail stores, and there's just a wide variety of types of businesses that have asked us to come in.
The synagogue says they may consider a follow-up training, but that's to be decided. Kayla DeRoche, YPR News.
After a tame fire season, the Flathead National Forest hopes to spark a number of prescribed burns in the coming weeks, but rain could limit how much work fire managers get done. Montana Public Radio's Aaron Bolton has more.
The Flathead National Forest released a list of 13 prescribed burns that range in size from 17 acres to over 1,000. Forest Fire Management Officer Rick Connell says one of the larger burns Flathead Valley residents are likely to notice is located just north of Whitefish.
And we've got 5 units up there, and we'll see, you know, when we come to burning, which ones we will do. We'll choose from them. We're not going to do all 5 at the same time.
Individual burns could be nearly 300 acres, and Connell hopes to complete the project over the next couple of years. The burns are aimed at preventing a larger wildfire that could contaminate the city's water source. It's also intended to improve deer habitat. The 1,100-acre Lindy Ridge burn south of Flathead Lake near Condon is also likely to be noticeable along the Mission Mountain Wilderness.
We'll be burning the exterior unit of the wilderness first to get that prepared. And then the whole rationale for this burn is so that fires that start higher up and away from the border of the wilderness have less likelihood of leaving the wilderness.
Connell says most burns proposed each year aren't completed. When and where fire managers are able to burn largely depends on approval from state regulators managing air quality. He says approval is fluid and depends on a number of factors.
What the weather is going to be like, how much vertical mixing of the atmospheres are going to be, who all wants to burn, where do they want to burn, is it valley bottom burning, is it mid slope, is it upper slope.
Rainy weather in the forecast could delay some of this year's burns. Connell says the Flathead National Forest will try to notify the public about larger burns through local news outlets and will also update when and where smaller burns are taking place on social media. Aaron Bolton, Montana Public Radio News.
Recent shifts in weather have prompted some agencies in Montana to lower fire danger levels, but managers caution fire season is still in swing. Yellowstone National Park yesterday dropped its fire danger to moderate. There are currently no fire restrictions in the park, but campfires are only permitted within established fire rings at campgrounds and backcountry campsites. Crow Agency Bureau of Indian Affairs Fire and Aviation reported 2 fires Sunday. A vehicle ignited the 1-acre roadside 505 fire. The driver stopped and used a fire extinguisher, but 2 engines were needed to contain the blaze. Crews also responded to the 32-acre Iron Horse fire at an illegal dump site in Lodgegrass. 3 engines worked the blaze at 1 a.m. Sunday. 2 engines followed up with a burnout of the grass nearby to prevent further spread. This is the 10th fire BIA crews have responded to this season in which burning trash canisters have ignited surrounding grass. Montana wildlife officials are investigating what's being described as significant fish kill along the banks of the upper Clark Fork River. Montana Public Radio's Edward O'Brien reports.
Montana Fish, Wildlife, and Parks fisheries biologist Nathan Cook fielded a report this weekend of several dead fish downstream of Warm Springs and upstream of Galen.
It took a little bit of looking, but within the first 100 yards, we found some dead whitefish, and then we started to see some dead trout and a dead sucker. You know, those are the three most common species that we find up in that part of the river, so it was alarming.
Cook uses the word significant to describe the fish kill.
Any fish kill where we observe more than just a couple, I would call significant because it's likely a big part of the population because, like I said, there just weren't many to begin with.
Cook saw some 32 dead fish in various states of decay along the riverbanks between Galen Road and Perkins Lane, an area still contaminated with high levels of pollution left over from decades of old mining operations.
I suspect we only saw a fraction of the fish that were originally killed by whatever event got them.
That's because birds were feasting on the carcasses. Cook suspects many other dead and dying fish sunk or were swept downstream. There's no definitive explanation yet, but he has a working theory.
Starting about Friday, this part of the world has gotten a lot of rain. Those fish kills that have happened in the past, a lot of times they were shortly after big rain events. Rain starts to run overland, and it'll pick up a lot of the metals from those contaminated areas that we call slickens. Those metals can get into the river.
Slickens are pieces of ground in the upper Clark Fork watershed devoid of life due to heavy metal contamination dating back to an early 20th century flood that washed mine waste off of the Butte Hill and downriver all the way to Missoula. Cook says there hasn't been a significant fish kill on that part of the upper Clark Fork since the late 80s or early 90s. Edward O'Brien, Montana Public Radio.
Montana Attorney General Tim Fox announced yesterday he's hired two specialists to help address the issue of missing and murdered Indigenous women. Olivia Reingold reports.
Monday is Misty LaPlante's first day as the Montana Department of Justice's missing persons specialist. It's one of two positions created last legislative session to tackle this trend. American Indians make up a third of missing persons cases in Montana while only accounting for 6.6% of the state population.
I can't explain my excitement on helping to minimize those numbers.
LaPlante, who's Blackfeet, said she'll do that by increasing coordination between different state, federal, and tribal agencies. She says she wants to lift the jurisdictional barriers she witnessed during her time as a Blackfeet law enforcement officer. Her role, created by the House bill known as Hannah's Act, is supposed to help streamline the process of reporting and investigating missing persons cases. Her colleague, Tina Chamberlain, will join the agency as the first looping in Native Communities Coordinator, a role created by another act from last legislative session. Her primary responsibility will be to help secure funding for a state database that tracks missing persons cases. Chamberlain comes to the agency from the Montana Bureau of Crime Control, where she oversaw federal grants geared towards helping crime victims. She starts later this week. For Yellowstone Public Radio News, I'm Olivia Reingold.
Montana is joining attorneys general from around the country in an investigation into Google's wide-ranging dominance in online markets and advertising. Montana Public Radio's Corin Cates Carney reports.
Mark Mattioli, the chief of Montana's Office of Consumer Protection, says Google is so big and powerful the company has state officials concerned it is shutting down competition.
We have been contacted by businesses that have complained about Google. Innovative businesses, that particularly small businesses, feel like they're being pushed out of the internet because Google's dominance is so significant.
The 50-state investigation is led by Texas. Mattioli says Montana will play an assisting role determined by other states leading the effort. There has not yet been a multi-state call to figure out how the 50 states will work together in the investigation.
The problem that Google poses for the whole country isn't any different than what it poses for Montana. We are suffering the same concerns. We used to think that the internet was open and transparent and free and competitive, and the purpose of this investigation is to make sure that that is the case.
Plans to probe the tech giant for potential antitrust violations was first reported by the Washington Post last week. Montana Attorney General Tim Fox announced Monday he was joining the investigation. I'm Corin Cates Carney, Montana Public Radio.
Montana is one of the biggest malt barley producers in the nation. Most of the grain goes to Anheuser-Busch and MillerCoors, but that's starting to shift as more microbreweries seek out local ingredients for a sense of place and unique flavors. Rachel Kramer reports researchers breeding barley for the craft beer boom will be speaking with brewers at a conference in Missoula this week.
At MSU's Post Agronomy Farm in Bozeman, graduate students pass bundles of barley up to someone standing on a thresher. She feeds the bundles through the top of the machine to separate the grain. Today's harvest is part of a process that can take a decade or more to develop new, improved barley varieties. Jamie Sherman is the director of MSU's Barley Breeding Program.
So, why do we do it? We want to improve yield, we want to improve disease resistance, we want to improve drought tolerance. But then we also want it to be end-user specific, so we want to improve food quality, increase nutrition, make it better for the organic market.
And she says, for Montana's growing craft beer industry, the Big Sky State has the second highest number of microbreweries per capita in the U.S. In 2008, there were around 20 microbreweries in the state. Now, a decade later, there are over 80. The industry generates more than $440 million annually. Sherman says a lot of craft brews are made with heirloom barley varieties from Europe, which offer a wider array of unique flavor profiles. Unfortunately, they don't grow very well in Montana's climate, so Sherman and her team are trying to create new varieties that combine the flavors of the heirlooms with cold and drought-tolerant barley. She says it's an opportunity to support farmers, brewers, consumers, and maltsters. They're the people who turn grain, usually barley, into a non-alcoholic liquid that can then be passed over to the brewers to ferment into beer. According to a renowned German scientist, quote, "Malt is the soul, hops the spice, yeast the spirit, and water the body of beer."
With the increase in microbreweries here in Montana, mm-hmm. has that affected the amount of malt barley that people are growing?
I think it will. I think what's going to happen is we've got some of these craft maltsters starting up too that will then feed into the craft brewers. And I think the craft maltsters in Montana will contract directly with growers.
Since developing a new variety takes a long time, breeders need data to make sure they're on the right track. That's where MSU's Barley and Malt Quality Lab comes in. Do you want to show me around the lab?
Sure.
Hannah Turner is the lab director.
These are our micro malters. We're able to fully control the whole process with these. So when water's coming in, what the temperature is, what the timing is.
Turner and the students who work in her lab take samples of grain and turn it into malt through a very specific process of soaking, heating, and drying. They test for things like the malt's protein to starch ratio, which affects how enzymes can turn starch into sugar, and the level of beta-glucan, which plays a role in the beer's thickness.
Jamie Sherman, when she came on as the breeder, right away recognized that in order to make selections for malt quality, we need more data earlier in the process. And to be able to do that, we needed to be able to test right here on campus.
It's the only lab in the Northern Great Plains region that can provide a complete analysis of barley malt. Before it was built in 2016, samples were sent to the U.S. Department of Agriculture's lab in Wisconsin. It's where pretty much all the other barley breeders send samples. They're limited on how many samples they can send in, and it takes a while to get results.
By establishing this lab, we more than triple the amount of data that we're able to produce for the breeding program.
Since it's a public lab, Turner gets samples from maltsters across the U.S. and Canada.
We produce what's called a certificate of analysis, and that's something that when they go to the brewers, they can say, here's my malt, here's what it's all about, and then the brewer can take that information to incorporate into their recipe and their brewing regime.
The lab is also working on a big flavor project right now in collaboration with researchers at Colorado State University. They've malted and tested hundreds of varieties to look at the chemical compounds to understand why they taste different. This information could help Montana's burgeoning market for local craft malts. The Butte-based company Montana Craft Malt opened a 10,000-ton malting facility 2 years ago, and more farmers have started malting their own barley to improve their profit margins selling a value-added product.
There's lots of people in the world that love beer but have never heard of malt before and don't realize how much work has gone into that whole process to create that delicious beer.
Turner hopes more outreach from the lab and the barley breeding program will change that. She'll be giving a presentation about her work, along with Jamie Sherman, at the Montana Brewers Conference in Missoula Thursday and Friday. With Yellowstone Public Radio News, I'm Rachel Kramer.
And that's what's happening in Montana today. Check in with Montana Public Radio's Montana Evening News for updates on the news of the day. For Yellowstone Public Radio News, I'm Jess Sheldahl. We'll have another episode of The Worm for you early birds tomorrow morning.
The Worm is produced by Jess Sheldahl for Yellowstone Public Radio. Theme music composed and recorded by Zach Jones at Rapscallion Recording. Meadowlark Call captured by Jay McGowan for the Macaulay Library. Partial funding for The Worm is provided by the Greater Montana Foundation, encouraging communication on issues, trends, and values of importance to Montana. More information about The Worm is available at ypradio.org.